sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Richard Elliott Friedman, one of the finest Bible scholars in the world today, and author of the books Who Wrote the Bible and The Bible Now. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's a pleasure being here to cool off a hot morning in southern Arizona. Midsummer has many benefits, but the cool temperance of climate here is not among them, which makes this a good day to think about places and people far from home. Also, it's Bastille Day this week, the National Independence Day for France. And wouldn't it be nice to be vacationing in France right about now? So, close your eyes, unless you're driving, and think, if you would, for a moment about France. You know, the Arc de Triomphe, the bridges over the Seine, the Eiffel Tower, wine, cheese, croissants with jam and coffee, great food, great art, lovely countryside, bicycle riders, a musical language, the tricolor flag, beautiful cities, and very rude people. You know, France, far from the heat of a Western summer, in time for Bastille Day. And so you ask, Rabbi, just what possible Jewish meaning can this have? Aha, I say, you probably don't know this, but the first nation in the Old World to guarantee full citizenship to Jews was revolutionary France. And without the French Revolution of 1789, Jewish history in Europe would have been very different. We are grateful to our own country of America, of course, whose 4th of July we celebrated last week, but we should retain some respect for the country that created the first Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and which benefited our people in particular. Here's my favorite weird historical question that most people don't get. Who broke down the walls of the ghettos in Europe, walls that had existed since the 1500s? Who was it who emancipated the Jews of Western Europe? And the answer is Napoleon Bonaparte. You see, when Napoleon was conquering Europe in the 1790s and early 1800s, his armies were fighting, at least in theory, for liberty, equality, and fraternity. He had no love for religion in general, and certainly not for the old order of the church that had enforced so many terrible rules and constraints on Jews throughout the Middle Ages and Renaissance and into modern times. But while Napoleon had no particular regard one way or the other for Jews, he was a non-commissioned officer from the island of Corsica and had little exposure to us, he nonetheless had a very strong sense of the necessity to break down the old bad order, the Ancien Régime. As he said, to the Jews as a commune, that is, a people, nothing. To the Jew as an individual citizen of France, all rights and privileges. Which was a very great change, revolutionary one, and a great gift at that time in the world. And so, as French armies crossed Europe, conquering, plundering, establishing their own governments everywhere, they also, almost as an afterthought, broke down the walls of each and every ghetto they encountered and let the Jews out. And they established, for at least some period of time, a new legal system, the Code Napoleon, which allowed Jews to go to university for the first time, to serve in the military, to be part of the civil service, to live wherever they wanted, to live as full citizens. It was an extraordinarily important moment in Jewish history. France enabled us to enter the modern world, at least wherever its armies had control, and the ghetto walls were never established in quite the same way or with the same force again, at least not until Hitler. That meant that we Jews suddenly could experience all that the modern world had to offer, and it made possible the extraordinary successes and accomplishments and experiences of Jews in modernity. It was actually while Napoleon controlled Germany that Reform Judaism was born, an Enlightenment form of Jewish belief and practice that catalyzed all modern Judaism, either inspired by it or in reaction against it. In the long run, it made possible Zionism and even the State of Israel. It was earth-shaking. And it was all because of France. Nowadays, you're likely to hear a great deal of anti-French rhetoric in Jewish circles. There's anti-Semitism, the Muslim immigrants perpetrate terrible acts against Jews, those French support the Arabs, and so on. But in truth, it is a much more nuanced picture than that today. The French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, has Jewish ancestors and has done a tremendous job countering anti-Semitism and improving Holocaust education, as well as building a French relationship with Israel on a national scale. And as we have heard, we contemporary Jews actually owe a great debt to the French Revolution, I guess, to Bastille Day. And so to play us in this morning, here's a Lecha Dodi from the French Synagogue, a composition of the great composer Samuel Naumburg for the Friday night service. That was a Lecha Dodi from the French Synagogue in honor of the French Independence Day this coming week, July 14th, Bastille Day. This also provides us a wonderful excuse to play a comedy cut from one of our all-time favorite Jewish comedians, the late and great Alan Sherman. Here's a special tribute to France and Bastille Day itself, when the French overthrew the tyranny of King Louis XVI and entered the modern world. It's called You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis.
Louis the 16th was the king of France in 1789. He was worse than Louis the 15th. He was worse than Louis the 14th. He was worse than Louis the 13th. He was the worst since Louis the 1st. King Louis was living like a king, but the people were living rotten. So the people, they started an uprising, which they called the French Revolution. And of course you remember their battle cry, which will never be forgotten. You went the wrong way, old King Louis. The population cried, 'cause all you did was sit and pet with Marie Antoinette in your place at Versailles. And now the country's gone kablooey, so we are giving you the air that ought to teach you not to spend all your time fooling around at the Folies Bergère. If you had been a nicer king, we wouldn't do a thing. But you were bad, you must admit. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine and shorten you a little bit. You came the wrong way, old King Louis, and now you ain't got far to go. Too bad you won't be here to see that great big Eiffel Tower or Brigitte Bardot. King Louis, we say fooey. disappointed all of France. But then what else could we expect from a king in silk stockings and pink satin pants? You filled your stomach with chop suey and also crepe Suzette's and steak. And when they told your wife Marie that nobody had bread, she said, let them eat cake. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine. It's somewhere in the heart of town. And when that fella there is through with what he's gonna do, you'll have no place to wear your crown. You came the wrong way, old King Louis. Now we must put you on the shelf. That's why the people are revolting, 'cause Louis, you're pretty revolting yourself.
Never let it be said that Too Jewish doesn't provide the finest and sophisticated Jewish culture at all times and seasons. That was Alan Sherman's You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis. But enough about France. When we return on Too Jewish this morning, we'll meet one of the great Bible scholars in the world, the fascinating Richard Elliot Friedman, author of Who Wrote the Bible and a new book, The Bible Now. Find out, by the way, who did write the Bible when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, to find balance in life is to find happiness. Now, I assume he was a smart guy, being a philosopher and all. So it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza, too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this. What one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese? Heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce? Crispy crust or lightly done crust? It's all in balance for each customer. And as Garaducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through 8th grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school, and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit THAAZ.org. We're delighted to welcome the two Jewish this morning, Professor Richard Elliott Friedman, a biblical scholar, the Ann and Jay Davis Professor of Jewish Studies at the University of Georgia. He's been at Georgia since 2006. Before that, he was the Katzin Professor of Jewish Civilization, Hebrew Bible, Near Eastern Languages, and Literature at the University of California in San Diego for, well, from 84 to 2006. He has theology doctorate in Hebrew Bible and Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations from a small university, Harvard, from 1978. He's best known, perhaps, for his really fascinating books, including Who Wrote the Bible and the wonderful Torah commentary, as well as other works. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
So, being a biblical scholar, you know, you wouldn't think 160 years in that the documentary hypothesis would still need defending, but it kind of does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's strange. I keep hearing people say, oh yeah, nobody believes that anymore. Nobody teaches that anymore. And it's very strange because I kind of know everybody in the field, and I'll often answer by rattling off all the major universities and the faculty I can think of who all still are there and teaching it and doing it. And I don't know what to make of this, rather than people sort of, you know, argument or evidence just saying, oh, yeah, well, nobody thinks that anymore.
You know, I went to Hebrew Union College, which had a long reputation as teaching the documentary hypothesis. They'd moved on to sort of accepting that and teaching a literary theory of the Bible. Is there any reason that those are not compatible?
No, it's all one, really. I mean, in my years at the University of California, San Diego, I was in a literature department for 30 years, and though on one hand, right, I thought I was doing something different from what my colleagues were doing. In another respect, you know, literary study is the documentary business is part of the whole picture of literary study. It's looking at the authors, it's looking at the times, it's looking at the literary qualities of the book. We do it all.
When people say that somehow what you do challenges faith, how do you answer them?
Just not my experience, or as far as I can tell, the experience of my students. I've taught for 35 years now, between 5 and 10,000 students, and I just don't get that from them. And I don't feel it myself either, in my own life or my friends' lives or colleagues of mine in the field. The critical study of the Bible is just understanding where it came from, how it came to be. It's about a commitment to the truth. It's using scientific method to get at whatever we can that sheds light on the text. I really don't think anybody's faith has to be so weak that it would be threatened by that.
The truth shouldn't threaten our faith.
Yeah. If they are inconsistent, then we're all in trouble.
We will talk much more with Professor Richard Elliott Friedman a little bit later this morning on Too Jewish.
Choosing the proper care for your mother, father, or other loved one isn't easy. David Shackman and his wife Ann are New Yorkers who recently found a home at Handmaker, Tucson's premier provider of assisted living and senior care.
I'm 88 years old. My wife is 86. And we like staying in Handmaker because people here are very courteous and the atmosphere is nice.
Well, I like the program here because they have entertainers, have a bingo. They made a luau with Hawaiian dances.
Handmaker gives their son, Ken, peace of mind.
I know that they are going to get good service and the staff will treat them as friends.
Handmaker, centrally located on Rosemont just south of Grant, includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, and Tucson's most caring staff. Call 881-2323.
The food here is excellent. It's as good as any good restaurant in New York City.
For a consultation and tour, call 881-2323 or go to handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, email us, please, at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows there or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. At a recent Talmud program here in town, one of the great Two Jewish Radio Show fans stopped me and told me how much she loved listening to the show each week. And then she said, I just wish you would play more Yiddish songs. Okay, here you are. One of the great treasures of Jewish musical tradition is its array of wonderful folk songs, especially Yiddish folk songs. Here is Chava Alberstein singing A Guter Zikoren, A Good Memory.
Amol is der Zikoren, Oich A Guter, Vone az men bet baim atoy vetuter, Er brengt amol zurik, Ashbiz deriye, Abliemel von der Kindheit in den Blien. Und demol wacht euch auf der Chuschareach. Und zu dem Over mit der Sprung der Geich. Und demol wacht euch auf der Chuschareach. Und zu dem Over mit der Sprung der Geich. Amol ist der Sikoren euch a guter. Und aus meinem Bett bei ihm a Teufeltu. Bringt amol zurück, als bis der Rie. Abel Himmel von der Kindheit in den Blien. Und demol wacht euch auf der Chuschareach. Und zu dem Over mit der Sprung der Geich. Und demol wacht euch auf der Chuschareach. Und zu dem Over mit der Sprung der Geich. Die Mama reißt die Hör mir mit dem Kehl. Mit Puder schmiert sie ohne weißen Sämen. Sie tut mir an die kinderische Kleider und führt mir ab zum Reben in einem Cheder. Sie tut mir an die kinderische Kleider und führt mir ab zum Reben in einem Cheder. Ich bin a Weiner, der Rebbe hat a Meul mit gelben Zähnen. Der Rebbe hat a größten schwarzen Sider, und dort ist mir der Allebeis der Wider. Nur wenn es tricken, nennen sich euch die Tränen, sie scheinen sich die Oisies wie die Stehren. Bei Heften sehe ihr Licht auf ganze Wörter, und stellen sich euch wunderliche Ehren. Wenn es drücken an sich aus die Tränen, sie scheinen sich die Oisies wie die Sternen. Bei Heften seh ihr Licht auf ganze Wörter und stellen sich euch wunderliche Erter. Und leuchten ab von größten schwarzen Sider, auf Jahren später bis in meine Lieder. Amol ist der Sikoren euch a guter. Und als mein Bett bei ihm hat euch tut er bringt amol zurück als bis der Rieh ablimmel von dem Kindheit in dem Blieh.
That was the wonderful Israeli Yiddish singer Chava Alberstein sharing a good memory, a guter Zikoren.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov. Good morning, Guy.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So, Guy, Americans don't know very much about the Israeli military. We think it's really successful, and that's about all we know. A lot of Americans don't know much about the military in general. Most Americans don't actually serve in the military, unlike Israel. Tell us a little bit about the cultural difference, and then let's get into some specifics.
Yeah. In Israel, all citizens serve in the military. There's some that are excluded. It's mainly the ultra-Orthodox on one hand and non-Jewish communities, especially the Muslim community, who are not drifted but are allowed to join in if they want to volunteer.
Of course, some do serve.
Some do serve. The Bedouins serve in the army. The Bedouins are Muslim. The Druze serve in the army. Many Christians are serve in the army. And in Israel, it's kind of a maturing experience to go into the army. And most teenagers are looking forward to their drifting into the army. And they plan for it.
And by drifting, you mean drafting into the army. That's accent. Okay.
Yeah, of course. And it's something to look forward to from the age of 15, 16. You already start planning. What do you want to do? Do you want to be in a more frontline unit, combat unit, or you want a more back office position? What is your health allowing you to do? It has a lot of elements of status, social status. If you go to a more honored unit, people respect you more.
Become a Golani, if you become a fighter pilot, if you're in one of the paratroop units, that's a big deal, right?
Yes, and it's a lot of empowerment because people need to understand that in Israel, everybody starts as a soldier at the age of 18. Out of the soldiers, only a few go to officer school after 1 year in the army. And when you're at the age of 19 or 20, if you're an officer, you're suddenly you're leading a group in some very challenging experiences. And you're only 20, and you need to make decisions that are sometimes life and death decisions. So you need to be very empowered. You need to be able to make very stressful decisions on the spot, you know, and usually in very, very short lengths of time. When people see on the news, they sometimes say, well, why didn't he make the other decision? Why didn't he do that? They didn't do the other thing. In reality, in a way, like in car accidents, things happen when there is an event. Things happen really, really fast. It's a matter of seconds, even less. And that young officer, whether it's a he or a she, needs to make the decisions on the spot. And we trust our young people. We trust them to be able to make those decisions. And I think the fact that all citizens are in the army is a main element of making the IDF so moral, because you have all the views, all the variety of community within the army. Also, I would point out on that element that the IDF is the only army in the world that set it as a legal obligation for a soldier to refuse a command if the command is immoral. And soldiers go to trial if they obey a command that is immoral.
It's fascinating. You know, we think obedience is so central to a military organization. In the Israel Defense Forces, they're taught sometimes you must disobey a command if it's wrong.
Sometimes you must say no.
Right.
Yes.
Fascinating. We will talk much more about this next week. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, the J Bar in Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, who was just again named a semifinalist for the National James Beard Award for Chef of the Year.
That's right. Good morning, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
Good morning and Mazel Tov. What's cooking at Janos now?
Well, all sorts of fun things. This is when my restaurants come into their own, when we get all the new flavors from the gardeners, from baby beets to little peas to citrus. Wonderful things for us to cook with. The menus are light. They're fun. We're doing our 10 terrific taste menu year-round now at Janos, which is actually a misnomer. It's 12 different things over 4 courses. Lots of little mouthfuls of great tastes.
You know, my wife Wendy calls your food magic food.
That's so nice of her to say that. If I cook magic food, the place I do it is at Janos. That's where we pull out all the stops, and that's where it's really, that's the height of the cooking that I do.
What's the phone number for Janos?
615-6100.
Or www.janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So there are these new summer camp programs in Europe, but not summer camp like, you know, when people go to Wisconsin or Northern California or something. It's really a different kind of story. Tell us what it's like.
Right. Unlike Camp Tomahawk or even right. Camp Ramah, some association of Jewish communities or federation or something in Belgium discovered that a good way to make money, but also reinforce Jewish identity among university students, was to create summer programs involving Jewish themes for people between 18 and 30. So they put together a series of choices, one of which I know about personally because a good friend of mine is sending his son to Bayonne, which is in the extreme southwest corner of France, known mostly for its hams, and its, in the old days, people who traveled between France and Spain had to get off one train and on another there because the track changed width, so trains couldn't cross, but that was the border station. It's quite near Biarritz, which is where all kinds of nice casinos are and surfing championships and whatever. Anyway, this young man, who's a student at the U of A, will join university students and graduate students from five or six other countries. Presumably most, if not all of them, are Jewish, but they're from, you know, Germany and France and England and the U.S. and Canada and wherever else, to clean up an old abandoned Jewish cemetery in Bayonne, which once had a hugely important Jewish community when it was part of the Golden Age of Spain. You know, it was in those days, it was part of Spain. It was ruled by the Muslims, and it much later was incorporated into France, at which point the Jewish community sort of withered. And certainly in my lifetime, it hasn't had any Jewish community to speak of. If there were a Jewish community of any size, they'd take care of the cemetery themselves.
As always, right.
Right. I mean, even Jewish communities of five people managed to
take
maintain
care of
the cemetery.
Right.
So he'll have an interesting time because on the one hand, he'll be bonding with other Jews his own age. On the other hand, he'll be learning about Jewish history in a fairly obscure corner of the world. This is the extreme southwest corner in France, of France. Not that often visited, by the way. And, you know, I think it's a great idea. I think parents interested in enriching summer experiences for their kids, if the kids don't have to work or don't have to go to summer school or whatever, should check out websites like this and find alternatives to the classic trip to Israel or Birthright trip or whatever, because this offers not a more important experience, but an alternative and complementary experience to a summer program in Israel.
It's a great idea and a great way also to do service, really, in an interesting way,
right,
for the Jewish world.
A mitzvah
indeed. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. From our Jewish husband department, this one comes. It's the story of a Jewish husband looking through the newspaper who comes upon a study. It says women use more words than men. Excited to prove to his wife his long-held contention that women in general, and his wife in particular, talks too much, he shows her the study, which says Jewish men use about 15,000 words per day, but Jewish women use 30,000. His wife thinks a while, then finally says to her husband, "That's because we have to repeat everything we say." And her husband says, "What?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and please be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read a portion from the middle of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. It's named after a man named Pinchas, whose story really began at the end of last week's portion of Balak. The situation is familiar. For the umpteenth time, the people of Israel have been disobeying the Torah and worshiping other gods. This time, the apostasy has reached epidemic proportion. Even the elite leadership of the people has begun to sample the religious wares of the Midianites and Moabites. Finally, one of the princes of the people challenges the authority of Moses publicly by taking a sacred prostitute into his tent while the whole assembly watches. As Moses and the other elders stand by in shock, unable to respond to such a chutzpahdik act, a young Kohen, a priest named Pinchas, steps forward. He kills the wayward prince and his consort and breaks the spell of the false religious practice. For this act, he is rewarded by God, which seems to validate his violent vigilantism. But there is more to the story than meets the eye. For Pinchas' reward for killing the couple is a breach shalom, a covenant of peace. Neither he nor any of his descendants is ever again permitted to go to war or to carry a spear. He must minister to the needs of the tabernacle, the rituals of the altar, and of purification and sacrifice, and he can never engage in any more acts of violence. He has broken the Israelites' latest fascination with paganism, but never again will that level of religious violence be tolerated. It must instead be sublimated to serve the needs of the community, an ongoing lesson about the dangers of religious fanaticism. Judaism refuses to countenance the kind of religious insanity that led to the Crusades, or to Jihad, or the Inquisition, or any kind of religious terrorism such as we see today. In spite of an occasional anomaly, our religious fervor is not designed to lead to violence. We are committed, fervently and firmly, to the same Brit Shalom, the covenant of peace that God places on Pinchas. So may it always be. This Torah portion of Pinchas also includes the rituals for each of the many festivals of the Jewish calendar. It explores the holidays, their structured cycle of celebrations that adorn the Jewish year, how time itself can be made holy, how the rhythm of life is made sacred. In place of violence, we offer holiness. A great lesson. When we come back on Too Jewish, the great Bible scholar Richard Elliott Friedman, author of Who Wrote the Bible, will tell us what the Bible teaches us today about abortion and other controversial topics. All that will return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
I'm Rabbi Jason Holtz, and I'm here to schmooze about the Jewish news. On Thursday, pro-Palestinian activists attempted to send a third flotilla ship to Gaza Strip and to break the Israeli blockade. These attempts come 1 year after a similar attempt, when the Israeli Navy intercepted the ship. In that incident, 9 people died when trying to defy the blockade. Now, the Greek Coast Guard is active in preventing these flotilla ships, saying they fear for the safety of those on board. Despite the naval blockade, the Gaza Strip is a hotbed of smuggling activity. Experts estimate that there are hundreds of tunnels leading into Gaza through Egypt. Through these tunnels, all sorts of goods are smuggled, including cement, weapons, and even cars. Israel instituted the blockade in 2006 after the radical terrorist group Hamas gained control of the Gaza Strip. Israel fears that materials currently making their way into Gaza can be used to enrich Hamas and be used against its citizens. In other news, the 13th European Maccabi Games, a sort of Jewish Olympics, opened in Vienna this week. An estimated 5,000 people attended the opening ceremony, marking the largest Jewish gathering in Vienna since the Holocaust. The opening ceremony was presided over Austria's president, Heinz Fischer. There are approximately 2,000 athletes from 37 countries around the world taking part in the games. I'm Rabbi Jason Holtz, and that's the news of Jews from around the world.
We're delighted to welcome back our distinguished guest this morning on Too Jewish, Richard Elliott Friedman, a biblical scholar, the Ann and J. Davis Professor of Jewish Studies at the University of Georgia. His new book is called The Bible Now, and it is really fresh off the press, or, I don't know, off the web or whatever we say about books today. His previous books include Who Wrote the Bible and his wonderful Torah commentary, as well as other works. He was at UCSD as a professor of Jewish civilization, Hebrew Bible, Near Eastern languages and literature for many years. Tell me a little bit about the Bible now and how you connect it to contemporary issues.
I guess I just wanted to be relevant in my old age after writing books about who wrote it and the history and the literary qualities of the Bible. I still thought the main reason people want something out of the Bible has to do with current decisions about important things. And so this book it has five chapters, and chapter one is homosexuality, chapter two is abortion, then women's status, death penalty. There are five little topics, nothing serious. They'll make me a lot of friends. And I wrote this book together with Shauna Delansky. She was once my PhD student, and now she's a professor in Canada. And we've written together some before, and especially on issues having to do with women and such. Even though I'm 100% pure and objective, it struck me that it might be a good idea to have a woman writing this with me as well. So we did it together, and I'm really proud of her. She was my great student in the past, and now she's my equal and colleague.
The Bible has a reputation, the Tanakh, for speaking very harshly on homosexuality. Textually, it only addresses male homosexuality. Tell me what you discovered or uncovered or explore in your first chapter.
Well, we did make a point of the fact, yes, that the laws explicitly only about male homosexuality, female isn't permitted. And no one's ever given a satisfactory explanation of why. They'll say it's something about wasting seed, but that's frankly absurd, and it's not true. And seed isn't mentioned in that passage, though it is in other sexual passages. And nobody who's against homosexuality is sitting at home going, "Oh my God, we mustn't waste that seed." I mean, that's really not why people react that way who are opposed. And the reason we say that they forbade male homosexuality but not female is that the biggest social difference between the world of the Bible and our world is that they had polygamy. A man could have many wives, and not all men will admit it, but it apparently is a very common male fantasy to be with two women, to see two women or more. It's in every pornographic movie ever made, I'm told. It's now on popular television shows, too. You can see all the women on Friends or on Sex and the City kissing each other and famous movie actresses doing it, and it's a fantasy. And in the biblical world, men could have that fantasy every night if they could afford to have multiple wives. And the last thing on earth they were going to do was forbid it. And you may think that's right or wrong as an explanation. What's amazing to me is nobody ever seems to have even proposed it and rejected it before, when, in fact, I think that really is the reason.
That is really fascinating. I mean, I've read a great deal on this. You are the first. In talking about women's issues more generally, the Bible has kind of a mixed record. It often is said to be harshly anti-women. Do you find it to be so?
No. What Sean and I said right at the beginning is this amazing thing that people make the anti-woman case, and they cite their passages, many of which are true and are there. And then others say, oh, no, the Bible is enlightened and revolutionary for women, and they cite their passages, and they're really true and they're there. And the point is that the Bible was a stage in this process, which didn't happen in one or two steps. So let's say it's 40 steps from women being completely downtrodden to our modern enlightened age now, where everything's just great and we're all equal. And let's say the Bible was stage 16. We could all sit here saying, gee, the Bible's terrible, it was only at stage 16. Or we could say, wow, the Bible was at 16 already. It's so much better than the other ancient Near Eastern cultures that were back at stage 11. That'd be a really boring conversation. It's better just to look at the specific texts and stories and the history and figure out what's important.
You know, I was just going to say in Pirkei Avot, it says, afach ba, afach ba, dechula ba, you know, turn it, everything is within it. And it's talking about the Bible, how much you can find.
On my bar mitzvah, my rabbi gave me a chumash, and he wrote those words on the inside cover. So they've been in front of my face now for I won't tell you how many years.
He did well, because you've certainly done a great deal to open up the Bible in ways I think other people don't see. Why do you think that is? What is it that you bring to it that's different from, you know, the 2,000 years of commentary?
Well, that's a big question. Look, the last 150 years or so, 200 years, and especially the, I will say, 65 years of my lifetime, have been a revolution. Two revolutions happened. One was the critical study of the Bible, and the second was the archaeological revolution. So we just have all these things available to us that they didn't know. I mean, Rashi is still Rashi, but when Rashi was writing his commentary on the Torah, that goat was still 900 years away from discovering the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were, and they'd been in the caves for 900 years at his point, and were going to be there for 900 years more. But I've got those scrolls. The great rabbis of the past didn't learn the text in Greek, so they didn't know about the differences and getting at the most accurate biblical text. But now any serious biblical scholar learns Greek and learns the scrolls. And until recently, everybody thought that the Canaanites, the ancient Near Eastern people, were all idiots who bowed down the statues. And we now know there was no idol worship in the ancient Near East, that they didn't have prostitution in the temples in the ancient Near East, and that they didn't sacrifice children in the ancient Near East, with one exception, the Phoenicians at Carthage. So we see a whole different world from what everybody's known until now. And that opens doors for us, to current scholars, to see things that people before us, who were just as smart as we were, didn't have the opportunity to see.
You know, we often say we stand on the shoulders of our ancestors in Torah study and Midrash and biblical commentary, but in a way, we can see stuff they never could see now. It's an extraordinary point. When you're looking at a contemporary question like abortion, in which Jewish tradition is actually very nuanced, what do you see in the biblical record?
I think most of the attempts people make to find material about abortion in the Bible just go nowhere. I mean, they're hopeless. The law, thou shalt not murder, really does not necessarily cover abortion. So people can't just say, well, the text says that, and that's good enough for me. We all know there's all kinds of killing that are not defined as murder, that including manslaughter, execution, killing in battle, killing in self-defense. I mean, all societies decide when it's murder and when it's manslaughter or something else. So if someone wanted just to cite the Ten Commandments, they can't just cite it. They'd have to then argue that abortion is consistent with the other things that are murdered there. The evidence is against that. There's only one clear reference to abortion in the whole Tanakh, and it's in Jeremiah 20, when Jeremiah curses the day he was born. He's so miserable at being a prophet that he even tops Moses and Elijah and Jonah, who all wish for death. He says, curse the man who brought the news to my father that a male child was born for him. Kill him, curse him, because he did not kill me from the womb, and my mother would be my tomb. Now, that's extraordinary.
Well, you know, as a congregational rabbi, I feel that way sometimes.
comes with the job, I guess.
I think so. It's an extraordinary statement, but that's unique, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I wouldn't argue anything from that. Oh, therefore, Jeremiah's pro-abortion. I mean, you know, Moses wishes he were dead. That doesn't mean Moses was pro-death. It's a man expressing his anguish. But in some ways, it does shed some light on the abortion issue. For one thing, because the word that Jeremiah uses there for kill me from the womb is the Hebrew root mot. It's not the Hebrew root retzach one in the Ten Commandments. So right. it argues against the Ten Commandments being cited in the abortion issue.
Well, the only connection I can think of isn't really biblical. It's Talmudic, in which a rotzeach, somebody who pursues another to kill him, you know, al tirtzach, don't murder, in the Ten Commandments, is used to apply actually to a fetus that is damaging or threatening the life of the mother. In other words, it's actually not someone who kills and aborts a fetus, but the fetus itself. So it's really kind of the reverse situation.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. I've heard of that, but I always beg off anything that happens CE. But that's, to me, that's Jesus, Columbus, Kennedy, Obama. You know, I mean, that's Bush. I don't really do AD.
Sorry. I didn't want to move you past your period. I apologize.
I'll trust you.
Okay. Always a dangerous thing to do. Let's talk about one more serious subject from your book, The Bible Now, the death penalty. Interesting question, interesting set of scenarios set up in the Torah and in the Bible in general. What do you find in looking at the death penalty, a hot-button issue today, as always, and also in biblical times?
Well, look, even in the United States, which is one of the industrial, educated countries that still has death penalty in a lot, not all, but a lot of the 50 states, it's really... only since the Supreme Court rulings, it's only if someone dies in the course of a crime, or except treason, I think. I'm not positive of that. But the death penalty, that is very limited. Whereas in the Bible, there are 27 crimes for which you can get executed. So the question is, how can this book that on the one hand values human life so much and says humans are created in the divine image say, on the other hand, that, you know, there are 27 different things you can be executed? And what Shauna and I concluded is that the main factor in all of that was that prisons weren't invented yet in biblical times. They just didn't have the options of punishment that we do. So, and I know you can say, well, there's a case where Joseph gets thrown in prison or Samson is imprisoned by the Philistines. But if you look, every case of imprisoning in the Bible is just they're put in some special place for the king's prisoners. It's not, we've never excavated a prison in ancient Israel or anywhere in the ancient Near East. So, and the Bible doesn't allow mutilation except in one case. It doesn't allow beating except in certain limited circumstances. Really, all there is execution and fines. So, yeah, they were quicker on the draw to execute. But we don't know if the Torah would have presented the matter differently and treated these crimes differently if they would have had the options that we have today. Prisons, you know, home with a thing on your ankle and so on. So we don't conclude something like, well, the Bible has execution, therefore execution's okay. We think that'd be a terrible mistake.
I have a confession to make. I use your commentary on the Torah very frequently. We do a Torah talk every Shabbat at my congregation, and I love your commentaries because, first of all, they're highly learned. Second of all, they're very accessible. And third, you say stuff that everybody else doesn't already say. In your approach to text, besides drawing on archaeology, sometimes you just think about things in a different way. Can you identify what that is?
Well, the short answer to that is no. I mean, I don't know why I see things as I do. We each travel, you know, whatever path in life, and it comes out of you. And if I credit anything, I would say for 20 years in California, my colleague was David Noel Friedman, who died just 3 years ago, who was, he and Frank Cross, my teacher, were the two great scholars of the preceding generation. And Noel was like that. He edited the Anchor Bible, which, you know, is the greatest commentary series in the Bible in history. It's like 3 million volumes have been sold of it.
It's incredible commentary still.
It's extraordinary what he did. He had the second longest entry in Who's Who in the World when he died. Hmm. And Elie Wiesel was one. He was two. So he had thought about every verse of the Bible individually while editing all those commentaries as no one else ever had. So you name a verse, any verse, and he gives you what absolutely everyone has said about it. But then he would show you some other angle that at first would sound crazy, and then you'd realize, no, wait, that's not crazy. Oh, I think he's right. And it was like that. And he taught me just to, without teaching as a lesson, he just taught me by example to do that with the text. And there may have been other forces that did it, but I think he's the main one. And if you look, we dedicated the book, actually, to his memory.
I want to thank Richard Elliott Friedman for a great visit. Time flew by. His new book is called The Bible Now, and it's available immediately. Thanks for a great visit here on Too Jewish.
Thank you. It's been great.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be the outstanding American Jewish historian, Deborah Lipstadt, whose new book on the Holocaust will shake everyone up. Our playout this morning comes from a favorite CD, the Putumayo Jewish Music Collection. It's from Sephardic singer Fortuna, her lovely rendition of Shalom Aleichem. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. Shalom Aleichem. I'm